Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls paper, The Courier, for Thursday, July 15th, 2021. I'm your reader, Mary Dove. Today, listeners, if your birthday is July 15th, you share it with actor Patrick Wayne, who is 82, singer Millie Jackson is 77, guitarist-singer Peter Lewis of Moby Grape is 76, singer Linda Ronstadt is 75, drummer Artemis Pyle of Lynyrd Skynyrd is 73, actor Terry O'Quinn from Lost and West Wing and Alias is 69, singer-guitarist David Pack of Ambrosia is 69, drummer Marky Ramon of the Ramones is 69, guitarist Joe Sitara is 65, and country songwriter Mac McNalla is 64. Actor Willie Amos, Eight is Enough, Charles's Change is 61, and model Kim Alexis is 61, actor Lolita Davovich is 60, and actor-director Forrest Whitaker is 60. All right, let's turn our attention to the front page of the Waterloo Courier for Thursday, July 15th. Our headlines read, Sentence Delayed in Jogger Slaying, Troopers' Texas Trip Has GOP Blessing, Tornadoes Hit Northeast Iowa, and Two Iowa Counties Now Second Amendment Sanctuaries. Okay, let's start with Tornadoes Hit Northeast Iowa, Sightings at Waverly, Shell Rock, Denver as Storms Batter Area by Courier Staff. Waverly. Tornadoes swept across northeast Iowa on Wednesday evening, damaging buildings, knocking down power lines, and slashing the Cedar Valley with much-needed rain. Thousands were left without power by a quick-moving storm system that spawned tornadoes and severe thunderstorms across a wide swath of Iowa. Tornadoes were spotted touching down near Shell Rock, 2 miles south of Waverly, northeast of Janesville, and northwest of Denver, and near Green Mountain. In Bremer County, there were reports of damage to at least one house and some farm buildings. Several homes in the Tama County city of Dysart sustained damage, according to KWWL-TV. The storms also damaged part of the football stadium at Owine High School, according to posts on the district's Facebook page. In Floyd County, twisters were sighted near the Avenue of the Saints at Nora Springs, at the nearby town of Rockford, and outside of Charles City. There were reports of damage across the county, according to a KAAL-TV. At least one home in the central Iowa town of Lake City was badly damaged, and tornadoes were confirmed in Calhoun County. Tornado watches for the Cedar Valley began early Wednesday afternoon and by 5:30 p.m., severe thunderstorms lashed the area as tornado warnings were issued for much of northeast Iowa, including Blackhawk, Bremer, and Buchanan counties. The storm knocked down trees and power lines around the Cedar Valley. At one point, more than 1,600 customers were without power in Waterloo, according to MidAmerican Energy, and 1,114 Evansdale customers were in the dark. MidAmerican Energy reported 2,550 customers were without power in the Waterloo region as of 7 p.m. Wednesday. Cedar Falls Utilities was reporting one outage as of that time, though it was likely reporting was delayed as MidAmerican was reporting several outages in Cedar Falls. A total of 8,290 outages were reported across the state. I hope you were all safe. Our next headline on the Thursday's paper of the Courier, Sentence Delayed in Jogger Slain. Defense Asks for Time to Investigate New Witness Information by journalist Ryan J. Foley, Associated Press. Iowa City. A judge on Wednesday delayed sentencing for the man convicted of killing University of Iowa student Molly Tibbetts after defense lawyers said they needed time to investigate new information pointing to other potential suspects. Kristen Bonanna Rivera, 27, was scheduled to be sentenced to life in prison without possibility of parole Thursday at the Poweshiek County Courthouse in Montezuma. Judge Joel Yates ruled Wednesday the sentence would be delayed until after he holds hearings on the defense request to compel prosecutors to release information about other suspects and to order a new trial. Yates said he would hold the first hearing Thursday and would later set a date for the hearing on whether to grant a new trial. Prosecutors remain confident in Rivera's guilt. State Attorney General Office spokesman Lynn Hicks said Tuesday, as of Wednesday, they hadn't submitted any filings in response to the new developments. A jury in May found Rivera guilty of first-degree murder in the stabbing deaths of Molly Tibbetts, 20, who vanished while out for a run in her hometown of Brooklyn, Iowa, in July of 2018. Prosecutors built their case on surveillance video showing Rivera driving in the vicinity where Tibbetts disappeared while jogging, DNA evidence showing that her blood was found in his car's trunk, and a partial confession in which Rivera led investigators to a remote cornfield where her body was found a month after she disappeared. Rivera, a dairy farm worker, claimed in his testimony that two masked men were responsible for killing and had forced him to drive them around and dispose of Tibbetts' body at gunpoint. Defense lawyers Chad and Jennifer Frizz requested a new trial last week, saying two witnesses recently came forward independently of one another to partially support Rivera's testimony. The witnesses told investigators that a 21-year-old man with a history of violence against women had claimed responsibility for killing Tibbetts. One of the witnesses said the man told him while they were at a county jail that Tibbetts had been kidnapped and brought to a local trap house used for sex trafficking before she was killed, according to Rivera's lawyers. The man told the witness that the house was owned by a 50-year-old who was running the trafficking ring and decided to have Tibbetts killed after the publicity surrounding her disappearance got too big. The man allegedly said he and an associate followed through with a plan devised by the 50-year-old to stab Tibbetts and frame a Hispanic man for the death. The Freezes said they learned Tuesday about a criminal investigation that centered on a 50-year-old man who allegedly met one of the sex trafficking victims in May of 2018 at a gas station in Brooklyn. Tibbetts' hometown of 1,700 people that is roughly 50 miles west of Iowa City. The woman told investigators that the man lured her to a house in the nearby town of New Sharon, where she was repeatedly drugged, raped, and held against her will until August of 2018. The woman said she sometimes would hear other women's voices in the home. Law enforcement officials used the information to obtain a warrant to search the home days after they interviewed her in March of 2019, but it had already been vacated by the 50-year-old man. They did not charge him with any crimes, and Mahaska County Sheriff said recently the kidnapping and sex trafficking allegations were never substantiated. Still, defense lawyers said in a motion that prosecutors should have turned over details about the investigation under their duty to provide exculpatory information in Rivera. They said the potential existence of a local trap house corroborates the new witnesses' claims. They are asking Yates to order the state to release information about prior sex trafficking investigations in the area, including any involving the 21-year-old and the 50-year-old. They noted that several other young people have gone missing from the area in recent years, calling that very troubling. In court filings, the Freezes noted that the 50-year-old man had come under scrutiny in the investigation into the disappearance of an 11-year-old boy, Xavier Harrelson. Xavier vanished from his trailer park in Montezuma on May 28th, during closing arguments of the Rivera trial. The defense noted the 50-year-old man is the former live-in boyfriend of Xavier's mother and that the two maintained a friendly relationship. Investigators searching for Xavier began looking for the man almost immediately, arrested him on an unrelated outstanding warrant in another county the day after the boy was reported missing. He has not been charged with any crimes related to the disappearance. Okay, our next headline on the front page of the Waterloo Courier, Troopers' Texas trip has GOP's blessing. Republicans support Reynolds' border aid by journalist Rob Barshard, Courier Des Moines Bureau, Des Moines. Iowa Republicans support Governor Kim Reynolds' decision to send Iowa State troopers to Texas to assist with security at the U.S.-Mexico borders. Democrats do not. Iowa's GOP governor this week confirmed 29 state troopers from Iowa had been deployed to provide assistance in the Del Rio area of southwest Texas for 16 days at an undisclosed cost to Iowa taxpayers. Few other details have been provided. Iowa Department of Public Safety officials declined to provide mission-specific operational information for the troopers who volunteered for the duty. On Wednesday, GOP members of the Legislative Council backed Reynolds' decision to answer a request for help from the Texas governor under the Multi-State Emergency Management Assistance Compact. Reynolds said last month she was helping Texas with border security because the rise in drugs, human trafficking, and violent crime has become unsustainable. Reasonable request. House Speaker Pat Grassley, Republican from New Hartford, said given Reynolds' concerns, he thought the request from Texas governor was reasonable. It's not just doing it for Texas, it's doing it for the United States. And it's added Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitaker, Republican from Ankeny. Utilizing these resources for a short amount of time, I think, will be worth it. Senate President Jake Chapman, Republican from Adel, laid the blame on the Biden administration for making this problem so much worse by failing to continue former President Donald Trump's plan to build a wall and stop illegal entry into the country. Chapman said he believes Reynolds has the overwhelming support of Iowans. Whether we want to admit that or not, those problems down on the southern border are becoming problems here in the state of Iowa. And so I absolutely supported that, and I think most in the legislature were happy with her providing that support, he said. Senate Democratic leader Zach Walls, Democrat from Coraville, said the Biden administration is dealing with the problems he inherited when he took office in January. I don't know if this is the best use of state resources, especially when we are seeing some rising crime in the state of Iowa, and that's happening under the governor's watch. So I think her focus should probably be keeping our own house in order, Walls said. Walls said the Biden administration is taking border control serious and taking steps to improve it, but it's not a problem that can be fixed overnight. President Trump had 4 years to fix the border problem, and he didn't do it. So that's a big problem that he, Biden, inherited from the Trump administration. Senator support. During his weekly call with reporters, Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa, said it was up to Reynolds to make the decision. She did. I think the governor is in the right for helping the governor of Texas out because the federal government is not doing its job. If it was doing its job, we wouldn't have anybody crossing the border. Senator Joni Ernst said during a separate teleconference that she believes Iowa taxpayers have a right to know what duties Iowa State Patrol troopers are performing in Texas, how much money is being spent, and other details of the mission. I believe transparency is always the best policy, and so I would love to know, of course, what state troopers are doing. I do support the governor's efforts there, but since our taxpayer dollars are being spent on that, yes, we should have some accountability. Ernst said one of the biggest concerns is that an uncontrolled border leads to human trafficking, gun trafficking as well, predominantly in Iowa, drug trafficking, especially methamphetamines. Governor spending. Senator Joe Bolcom, Democrat from Iowa City, said he regularly drives on Interstate 80, and I rarely see a state trooper. I don't know how we have 25 or 30 troopers available to go down to the southern border and take over some federal role in securing our border when we don't have adequate resources to make sure that Iowa's roads are safe. Bolcom, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Appropriations Committee, said Reynolds should have consulted the legislature before sending troopers to Texas. The Republicans who run the legislature seem to have very little interest in overseeing their governor's spending habits, he said. They basically have put it in neutral and then given her the authority to do whatever the heck she wants. Our last article on the front page of the Courier Two Counties in Iowa, Now Second Amendment Sanctuaries by David Pitts. Des Moines. Officials have voted to declare two Iowa counties as Second Amendment sanctuaries where any laws hindering gun rights cannot be enforced, joining similar efforts across the country and coming even as Iowa has significantly loosened firearms regulations. Republican supervisors in Jasper County unanimously approved a resolution Tuesday, and Republican supervisors in Hardin County did the same Wednesday, becoming the first Iowa counties to implement such measures. Elsewhere in the United States, at least 1,200 local governments have declared themselves sanctuaries, insulated from state and federal gun laws since 2018, when high-profile mass shootings prompted calls for stronger regulations. An ordinance passed in Columbia County, Oregon, last year is the first to face a legal challenge over whether it can be enforced. The Iowa resolutions say the county supervisors want to ensure that citizens' rights are protected against legislation on the state or federal level. The Jasper County resolution says federal and state lawmakers cannot be solely trusted to protect people's Second Amendment rights, and that any legislation or order from a federal or state legislature or executive that infringes on constitutional gun rights shall not be enforced by any individual employed by the Jasper County Sheriff's Office or any employee of Jasper County. "Let's hope it is never needed," said Supervisor Doug Couples. Supervisor Brandon Talsma said the Second Amendment has come under attack again and again, and we wanted to make it clear that Jasper County will defend its citizens' civil liberties. Iowa is among several Republican-led states that have passed laws allowing for carrying of guns without requirement of a permit. The law that took effect July 1st also eliminates a requirement that people pass background checks to obtain permits to purchase handguns in sales outside of those completed by federal licensed dealers. Data from the Iowa Department of Public Health shows gun deaths have been surging in the state before the passage of the new law. A record 353 Iowa residents died from gunshot wounds in 2020, including 263 suicides, 85 homicides, public health data shows. The shooting deaths represent a 23% increase from Iowa's previous high of 287 in 2019, including an 80% jump in homicides. In Hardin County, seven people spoke on the issue Wednesday morning. Four men supported the measure, with one talking about his fear the federal government will take away his right, and another arguing it will limit how far the government can go. Two women opposed the resolution. "This is just a piece of political theater showing red meat to a certain set of voters who you want to keep their attention so they vote because they're the least likely group to vote," Julie Dunnan said. "Do any of you supervisors actually believe that there will be legislation to take everyone's guns? It's ludicrous." The fear of regulation eroding gun rights comes as Democrats in Congress are making a new push to enact the first major new gun control law in more than two decades, starting with stricter background checks. However, passage appears unlikely because the legislation would likely need bipartisan support. President Joe Biden has called for Congress to strengthen gun laws, including requiring background checks on all gun sales and banning assault weapons. A group advocating for stricter gun control said local politicians and law enforcement officials don't get to decide which laws they enforce. "Our leaders should be focusing on common sense gun safety protections that will keep our communities safe, instead of refusing to enforce public safety laws that actually make a difference," said Tracy Kennedy, chapter leader of the Iowa chapter of Moms Demand Action. All right, listeners, let's see what's happening in the Cedar Valley. Friendship Village wants to build pickleball courts. 75-year lease could add 100 parking spots at Bontrager Park, by journalist Amy Rivers. Waterloo. A plan to add pickleball courts and more parking to a city park that will be constructed and paid for by a nearby long-term care facility is one step closer to approval. The Waterloo Leisure Service Commission unanimously recommended a 75-year lease agreement with Friends of Faith Retirement Home, which operates Friendship Village at 660 Park Lane. Friendship Village will pay the city $10 for the lease, which will run through December 31, 2096. The City Council will vote Monday to set a public hearing on the matter for August 2nd. The long-term deal will allow Friendship Village to lease a 2.13-acre portion of next-door Western Bonteridge Park in order to maintain its stormwater detention, construct up to 3 pickleball courts, and add a 100-stall parking lot, according to city's documents. The agreement specifies Friendship Village will keep the property open and available to the public, except by advance approval of the Leisure Service Director. Obviously, they'll have instances where they'll need to have exclusive use of the property, Leisure Service Director Paul Hunting said at the Commission's board meeting Tuesday. But I think we're kind of getting the best of both worlds. We're maintaining the park property, but also improving it with pickleball and grading it. Friendship Village is otherwise landlocked at its location, said Friends of Faith attorney Michael Young, and the Bonteridge agreement came after years of discussions with the city and neighbors nearby and how to best expand. We do like to see this as infill, and we do appreciate you're not abandoning the area, said Andrea Miller, city economic development specialist. The taxable income is going to be pretty large and significant. We do see this as a very positive project for the city. Young said Friendship Village expects to spend a little over $500,000 on renovations to the park, including around $50,000 on pickleball courts. We really think this will be kind of a win-win situation for Friendship Village, for the community, for the neighborhood around it, Young said. When it's all built out, we think it will really improve this area. Waverly Shellrock superintendent gets raise. Ed Clamforth receives extension and a 3% jump in total compensation, by journalist Andrew Wynn, Waverly. Superintendent Ed Clamforth got a raise this week as his contract with Waverly Shellrock Community Schools was extended by the Board of Education. Ed was provided a total compensation increase of 3%, which aligns with the same total package increase that was given to our employee group, said Board President Kelly Flagey, including administrators, teachers, and support staff. That boosts his annual compensation by $7,393 to a total of $252,605. Of that amount, $214,180 is his salary, which grew by $6,671. The total package increase also includes district contributions to the Iowa Public Employee Retirement System, Social Security, and insurance premiums for health, life, and long-term disability. Fledgey noted that there were no other changes in any other components of his contract, as it was extended by the board. It is a rolling 3 years, so every year we renew it for the subsequent 3 years. Clamforth, who is starting his ninth year of the district, was evaluated by the board in May, based on standards that are applicable to Iowa superintendents. Across the board, all board members felt very strongly that Ed is performing at a high level, leading the Waverly Shellrock School District, said Flagey. She acknowledged that COVID-19 pandemic threw some wrenches into the district's efforts to meet certain goals, but praises Clamforth's performance. His leadership, from our perspective, is excellent, and he's done a great job leading through the challenges that all school districts are experienced in the last year. The 2-year agreements were approved this spring for all district employees. In April, the Waverly Shellrock Education Association contract included salary increases of 3.26% for the first year and 3% the second year. In May, wage increases of 3.04% the first year and 3% the second year were approved for support staff, along with salary and benefit increases of 3% each year for district directors and administrators. In other business, the board approved the appointment of Abby Meester as the district's human resource director, a position that is being shared with Dyke New Hartford and Grundy Center Community Schools. She has served Waverly Shellrock in that role for the past 3 years through a shared agreement with the City of Waverly, which switched to a full-time human resource director. Meester, who will spend 60% of her work time at Waverly Shellrock, 20% on each of the other two districts, is being paid $87,000 annually. As an incentive for sharing, Clanford said each district will receive $36,085 in state funding to offset the cost of the position, which is equivalent of a supplement of 5 students. Increasing the driver's education fee through Cedar Falls-based provider Golden Rule, driving school by $5 to $380, will start in January. Some entertainment in the Cedar Valley, Little Miss Sunshine. Hilarious and poignant musical opens July 23rd on the Waterloo stage by journalist Melody Parker. Waterloo. Sophie Lang describes herself as a very calm and very chill kind of person. The 14-year-old landed the lead role as Olive Hoover in the Waterloo Community Playhouse musical Little Miss Sunshine, which will open July 23rd, and the character couldn't be more different than Lang. Olive is really exuberant and up in everyone's business all the time. She loves to dance, she loves to play, and it's fun to be the star, said Lang, who has previously been cast in smaller roles. She starts at West High School this fall. Little Miss Sunshine is a modern musical comedy adapted by James LaPin and William Finn from the Oscar-winning movie about a family trying to change their luck by chasing after Olive's coveted beauty pageant title. It's such a fun show and surprisingly poignant, said artistic director Greg Holt. Like the film, the musical puts this dysfunctional family on the road in a rusted-out VW van, making an 800-mile trek to California. The cast includes the beleaguered mom, a suicidal uncle, and a silent and moody teenage boy and dad. A failing motivational speaker, along with Olive and her grandpa, kicked out of retirement home for using drugs, decide to become Olive's choreographer. The family hits plenty of potholes along the way, Holt said. Some family situations come up that are universal and audiences can relate to and recognize. The musical has some adult language and situations. Grandpa, for example, has choreographed Olive's dance routine with some inappropriate moves to the song Shake Your Banduka. Unfortunately, he remembered the moves from strippers he saw years ago. That's been one of the biggest challenges for Lang. That kind of dance is something I would never normally do. It's one thing to learn the moves and then think, oh wait, I have to do this in front of people? The cast and crew think it's hilarious and the audience will love it. Lang said she's having a grand time, getting to know the other cast members as well. Holt spoke with Lang's mom about the role so there were no surprises. The music may be unfamiliar to audiences, but it's still memorable, Holt said. I've been hearing it over and over again, and I'm still enjoying the heck out of it. It's actually exceedingly difficult music, a little tricky to sing and perform. Songs include The Way of the World, No Man's Land, No One Gets Left Behind, and Do You Think There's a Heaven? In addition to the 6 family members, there is a 6-person chorus that fills a variety of roles. A live band will be on stage throughout the show. Music director Luke Overton and Jalen Madison. Choreographer is Camille Malchek. Set design by Keely Wright is representational with the use of multiple backdrops. Technical staff is Scott Schuster and Dante Benjinges is lighting designer. Annette Rubin is costume. Everyone has come together and worked hard to form a strong ensemble set and crew, and put together a great show, Holt said. Well, good luck to the Little Miss Sunshine cast. All right, listeners, you are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls paper for Thursday, July 15th, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Lindsay A. Lease. 37, of Cedar Falls, died Monday, July 12, 2021, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics of complications from COVID-19. She was born November 14, 1983, in Waterloo, the daughter of Kenneth and Vicki Wagner, Lease. She was a 2002 graduate of Waterloo West High School. She worked as an independent contractor for delivery services in the area. She is survived by her parents, Ken and Vicki Lease of Waterloo, a son, Kindley Lease Demise of Cedar Falls, a brother, K.J. Lease of Waterloo, and three sisters, Jen and spouse Steve Davis of Cedar Falls, Elizabeth Lease of Waterloo, and Abby and spouse Scott Morley of Waterloo. Three nieces, Ashley and Krista Davis and Natalie Watson, a host of aunts, uncles, and cousins, and her faithful companion, Roscoe. Preceded in death by her maternal grandparents, Lou and Bob Wagner, and paternal grandmother, Wilma Lease, services will be held at 11 a.m. on Tuesday, July 20, 2021, at Kearns Funeral Service, Kimball Chapel. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Monday, and also 1 hour before the service at the funeral home. A video of the service will be posted at the funeral home website. Memorials may be directed to the family. Kearns Funeral Service Kimball Chapel is in charge of the arrangements. 319-233-3146. Online condolences may be left at www.kearnsfuneralservice.com. Jean Elizabeth O'Brien of Waterloo was 97, died Wednesday, July 14, 2021, at Unity Point Hospice. She was born September 30, 1923, in Casper, Wyoming, the daughter of George and Martha Bayer Hurlink. She married Wilfred W. Bill O'Brien on February 15, 1946, in Trinity Lutheran Church, Waterloo. He died May 17, 1996. Jean was employed with DHS for 23 years, retiring in 1983. She is survived by two daughters, Marcy Kuntz of Waterloo and Molly, and spouse Tom Walsh of California, a son-in-law, Jim Kuntz of LaPorte City, four grandchildren, Libby and spouse Eric Vanderloom of Des Moines, Emily and Charles Dunn of Ankeny, Brett and Meg Walsh, Brian and Gina Walsh, both of Orange, California, seven great-grandchildren, Madison, Drew, Jay, Dunn, Pryor, and Penn, Ben Hucum, and Sophia Walsh, Rollins Walsh. Services will be held 10:30, Monday, July 19th, at Ascension Lutheran Church, with burial in Waterloo Memorial Park Cemetery. Public visitation will be from 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday, July 18th at Hagerty Wyckoff Garup Funeral Services on West Ridgeway, continuing for 1 hour before services at the church on Monday. Memorials directed to the church or Valley Lutheran School. Online condolences may be left at www.hagertywyckoffgarup.com. Daniel Fred Yuncombe of Sumner, 55, and formerly of Dunkerton and formerly of Sumner, died Monday, July 12, 2021, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City due to complications from COVID-19. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Monday, July 19, 2021, at St. John Lutheran Church in Sumner, with Reverend Tracy Hinkle officiating. Burial will follow at the church cemetery, rural Sumner. Visitation will be held on Sunday, July 18th from 2 to 6 p.m. at St. John Lutheran Church in Sumner and for 1 hour preceding services at the church on Monday. Memorials may be made to the family for later designation. Daniel Fred, son of Lyle and Marilyn Neiman Yuncombe, was born September 24, 1965 at Community Memorial Hospital in Sumner. He was baptized on October 24, 1965, and confirmed May 25, 1980, both at St. John Lutheran Church in Sumner. Dan attended the Sumner schools with the class of 1985. He was employed with Warren Transport in Waterloo for the past 32 years. On September 22, 2012, he was united in marriage to Julie Maurer at Mount Hosmer near Lansing. The couple made their home in Dunkerton. Dan was a life member of the St. John Lutheran Church, the Sumner Trailblazers, and was involved in Boy Scouts during his youth. He thoroughly enjoyed being outdoors, whether it be fishing, annual trips to Eagle Lake in Minnesota, snowmobiling, or four-wheeling. Dan's most enjoyable moments were time spent with family and friends. Dan is survived by his wife, Julie of Dunkerton, three siblings, Linda and spouse Larry Sparks of Sumner, Case and Jerry Delagardell of Hawkeye, Tom and Sally Youngtum of Sumner, stepmother LaVon Youngtum of Sumner, two siblings, Sandy and Mike Wilson of Frederica, Randy and Deb Schultz of Sumner, Mitch and Brenda Schultz of Monroe, Connecticut, and Julie and Burke of Buckingham, sister-in-law Debbie and Mike Bathy Maurer of Olwine, brother-in-law David and Irwin Maurer of Fairbank, many nieces, nephews, great-nieces, and great-nephews, and his dog Tucker. He was preceded in death by his parents, his sister Susan, mother-in-law Joanna Maurer, father-in-law Dennis Maurer, sister-in-law Kathy and Gary Wright, and brother-in-law Dennis Maurer. Becker and Son Funeral Home in Sumner is assisting Dan's family. Online condolences may be left at www.beckermillersreading.com. James Scott Topin, 88, of Winnebago, Minnesota, passed away July 8, 2021 in Mesa, Arizona. He retired from John Deere in 1995. Military services will be at Waterloo Memorial Park Cemetery, 3430 West 4th Street at 10:30 a.m. August 9th. Celebration of Life will be at Cedar Falls Ambits, 1934 Irving Street in Cedar Falls at noon. Gregory Lynn Anderson, 59, of Eldora, Iowa, passed away Friday, July 9th, 2021. A funeral service will be held Friday, July 16th, 2021, 10:30 at Fredsville Lutheran Church in rural Cedar Falls. Visitation will be held Thursday, July 15th, 2021, from 4 to 7 p.m. at the church and 1 hour prior to the services. There will be a Masonic service following visitation. Greg was born the son of Gary and Marcia Deacon Anderson. Greg graduated from Dyke High School in 1980 and UNI in 1984. Greg worked at Eldora State Training School for 34 and a half years. He was preceded in death by his father, maternal grandparents Elmer and Marlis Deacon, paternal grandparents Erhard and Agnes Anderson, uncles Ron and Kenny Anderson. Greg is survived by his mother, Marcia Anderson, his sister Beth and partner Gary Cohen, brother Mark, nephew Zach Anderson and Heather, great niece and nephew Blakey and Noah. Greg is also survived by aunts, uncles, Dixie Spain, Mike and Karen Deacon, Amy Jensen, Diane Burns, as well as many cousins and friends. Memorials may be directed to the family. Janet Ruth Neiman of Cedar Falls was 84, died Tuesday, July 13, 2021, at Mercy One Waterloo Medical Center. She was born December 15, 1936, at the family farm near Clarksville, Iowa, the daughter of Lewis and Esther Nodemeyer Diekman. She married Gordon Neiman on October 7, 1961, at Trinity Lutheran Church in Waterloo. He preceded her in death on May 19, 2016. Janet was a secretary with home health at Saratori Memorial Hospital. Survivors include two daughters, Lisa Neiman of Cedar Falls and Michelle and Wade Eichhorn of Ely, Iowa. Two grandchildren, Audie and Asher Eichhorn. One brother, Dr. Merwin Diekman of North Carolina. Two sisters, Beverly Truman Kaiser of Waterloo and Mary Ann and spouse Jerry Oberman of Mount Kinney, Texas. And many nieces and nephews. Services will be held 10:30 a.m., Monday, July 19th at Nazareth Lutheran Church with burial in Fairview Cemetery. Visitation will be from 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday at Dahl Van Hove Show Funeral Home and 1 hour prior to service time of the church. Memorials may be directed to the church. Joanne Hook DeWoolis passed away peacefully on July 12, 2021 at the Grundy County Memorial Hospital, surrounded by family. Visitation will be held from 4 p.m. until 6 p.m. on Friday, July 16, 2021 at Abel's Funeral and Cremation Service, Inglecoast Chapter and Grundy Center. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, July 17, 2021 at the First Presbyterian Church in Grundy Center. Burial will follow at Rose Hill Cemetery in Grundy Center. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Grundy County Memorial Hospital. Born May 24, 1930, she was the eldest daughter of Herman and Leora Hook. Born in Buckeye, Iowa, she grew up in Waterloo and Wellsburg, where she graduated from high school. She pursued a college education at Iowa State Teachers College and Indiana State University. Her first teaching assignment was a one-room country school. Later, while raising her daughter, she attended UNI to complete her teaching degree. She taught in Dyke Elementary, where she was an awesome and dedicated teacher. Following her teacher degree, she sold real estate for GNB. After marrying her college sweetheart, Jim, she became a mother of three daughters who kept her life full of activities and fun. Being a talented seamstress with a sharp eye for fashion, she found pleasure in making clothes for the girls. As a member of the First Presbyterian Church in Grundy Center, she taught Sunday school and was an elder. With an unshakable faith and positive attitude, Joanne was able to persevere through the various health challenges she was faced with throughout her life. Joanne was a gentle soul, kind to all she met, and loved by all who knew her. She was the epitome of elegance, patience, and grace. Music lifted her spirits. She found joy in singing, dancing, and a daily bowl of ice cream, sometimes two or three. She loved the outdoors, walking and biking. As she grew older, she found joy in watching all the birds in the backyard, garden paradise created by Jim. Joanne is survived by her husband Jim and their three daughters, Jan DeWoolis, Jody Deary, and spouse John, Jane Matthews, her grandchildren, Jennifer Condor, Jason, Johnny Deary, Ben Sievers, Michael Matthews, and six great-grandchildren. Joanne is also survived by her sister, Linda Chandler, and brother, Jack Hook. She is preceded in death by her parents and son-in-law, Ray Seaver. The family would like to express gratitude for the compassion care Joanne received from the nurses at GCMH. All right, listeners, let's turn our attention to some sports news. Professionals return to at Waterloo Open. Strong field expected at prestigious event by journalist Craig Seeker. Waterloo. The professionals are back, and Brian Middleton couldn't be happier. The pros missed out on the 2020 Waterloo Open because of the COVID-19 pandemic, but they are returning for this year's popular golf event. The Waterloo Open is scheduled for Friday through Sunday at three top local courses. The pros will play at Irv Warren Memorial Golf Course for all 3 days. The amateurs are scheduled to play at Gates Park on Friday, South Hills on Saturday, and Irv Warren on Sunday. We are obviously very excited to have the professionals back playing again this year, said Middleton, the committee chairman for the Waterloo Open. We have had some great players come through here in past years, and we are expecting another excellent field again this year. It will be fun watching them compete. Winners of the professional division have earned $50,000 paycheck in past years. That number will be adjusted this year with a smaller field of 128 players taking part this summer. Golfers from as far away as California, Arizona, and Florida are among the entries. Our numbers aren't quite as high as this year because we're coming out of COVID and everything, Middleton said, but we still have a very strong field coming in. Middleton said there are 200 amateurs entered in the Waterloo Open. The amateur division was contested last year with Marshalltown's Nate Vance turning in a phenomenal 54-hole performance to cruise to a victory. He recorded an eagle and three birdies in his first six holes en route to a 5-under par round of 67 on the final day at Irvine. Vance's 17-under total was 9 shots better than runner-up Nate McCoy. "We have had some outstanding amateurs playing here in the past, and we have another top-level field coming this year." Okay, and it's continued on page 3. Middleton said, "There will be a lot of really good college players, plus a number of top local players. It will be interesting to see how it plays out. 2018 champion Dusty Drenth of Davenport is among the top amateurs expected to contend this week. Drenth finished 13 in the 2020 Waterloo Open. He placed 11th against a strong field in the Joliet Amateur last month. "I've been playing well," he said. "I'm always excited to come back and play in the Waterloo Open. It's a tournament my dad and I have been playing in for years. I enjoy teeing it up with him, and I'm looking forward to making more memories. I enjoy playing in the professionals on the last day. It's just a fun event to play in." The Cedar Falls JCs continue to run an event that is billed as Iowa's largest and oldest professional golf tournament. The Pro-Am will be held Thursday with a long driving contest scheduled to be held after the round. A hole-in-one prize will also be offered for anyone who can achieve the rare feat. "It's going to be a great week of golf," Middleton said. "We're hoping to have a great competition and bring some high-caliber play to Waterloo once again. We're really looking forward to it." All right, let's see. In college sports, Alberts is Nebraska athletic director. Cedar Falls native was standout football player for the Huskers. By Steve M. Simple, Lincoln Journal Star, Lincoln, Nebraska. Trev Alberts didn't think he'd get emotional, but standing inside Memorial Stadium, the very same structure where Alberts made his name known to the state, brought it all back for the former award winner. "I love this place," Alberts says as he stopped to collect his emotions. "I learned so much as a young man. I don't take this responsibility lightly. I will do everything I can to what I can for this place." With his family by his side, Alberts was introduced Nebraska's 14th athletic director Wednesday. The Cedar Falls, Iowa native will officially begin his new job Monday after leading the Nebraska-Omaha athletic department for 12 years. "I would have never left UNO for any other job at Nebraska," Alberts later added. Nebraska has been without an AD since Bill Moose announced his retirement June 25th. UNL Chancellor Ronnie Green, who led the search for Moose's replacement, said he looked at internal and national candidates. "At the end of the day, Alberts checked all the boxes," Green said during Wednesday's news announcement. "He is first and foremost student-athlete focused. He's a game changer. He appreciates the big chances that are going on right in intercollegiate athletes. He understands the talent that has amassed here." Green said they identified Alberts as the leading candidate over the weekend. NU officials shook hands with Alberts on Tuesday night to solidify the deal. University of Nebraska President Ted Carter called Wednesday a great day for the university. "Quite honestly, it's a great day for the entire state of Nebraska," he added. "The one thing I was looking for, I wanted a leader. I feel like I know a great leader when I see one." Carter said, "There were high-profile ADs around the country that were interested in the job," and Green said there was a pool of 25 candidates and 8 lead candidates, but Albert was at the top. "We needed to get this right," Carter said. "When you think about how fast we got to this decision, it's pretty incredible." All right, well, good luck to Alberts. In other news in the sports, Buck Cern, third straight win. Waterloo earns win in first game of Twin Bill by staff report. Waterloo. The Waterloo Bucks continued their winning ways, earning a 14-8 baseball win over the Rochester Honkers on Wednesday afternoon at Riverfront Stadium. The Bucks won their third straight game after dropping their previous six contests, where Lou won a division title in the first half of Northwoods League play. The Bucks jumped out to a 6-0 lead on a day where the offenses took center stage. The hitting stars were numerous for the Bucks in the victory. Jackson Lyon led the way in his Waterloo debut. On his first swing as a Buck, Lyon blasted a grand slam as part of the team's six-run first inning. Ryan McNally went 2-for-4, scored twice, and knocked a run. Jalen Smith contributed a pair of hits for Waterloo. He also drove in two runs. The Bucks built their lead to 12-5 in the fifth, scoring three times in that inning. Johnny Trincher and Josh Kasvick each collected RBI signals for Waterloo. Kasvick finished with two hits to raise his batting average to 378. The Bucks scored their final two runs courtesy of a two-run Dalton Chandler signal to the eighth inning. Bucks pitcher Cameron Landry struck out 10 batters in five innings of work. He allowed three hits and one earned run. Waterloo's Nolan Santos earned his first save with three scoreless innings to close the game. He struck out two while scattering a hit and a pair of walks. All right. Let's see if we've got time for one more article for Cedar Valley News. USS Iowa crew visits Irish Fest, Waterloo. The crew of the USS Iowa will come on hand at Irish Fest for a meet and greet with festival goers. The USS Iowa is a Virginia-class submarine currently under construction in Connecticut. Five of the crew's more than 100 sailors are from Iowa. The USS Iowa is also the first submarine that will have female sailors on board. Crew members will meet local residents and spend one day performing community service. This year's Irish Fest is August 6th to the 8th in Lincoln Park area. People's Clinic plans celebration. Waterloo. In celebration of National Health Week, August 8th through the 14th, People's Clinic Health will host two community events. From 10 to 2 p.m., August 9th, a free garage sale will be held at the clinic, 905 Franklin Street. There will be clothing, accessories, and other household items available at no cost. Each person who comes can fill one bag with items. Bags will be provided. The fifth annual Big Ten event will be from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. August 11th at the clinic. There will be a free food while it lasts, fun, and local community resources for attendees to enjoy. Both of these events are free and open to the public. For more information, go to www.peoples-clinic.com. Youth Center holds giveaway in Waterloo. Shady Lane Youth Center will have a giveaway of clothing, household furnishings, electronics, and more from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on July 24th through July 31st at 1322 Shady Lane. The Congregation of Grace Reformed Church is collecting good, used, and slightly used items to give away to those in need. Clothes must be laundered and in good working condition. You can call 319-233-4341 for questions. All right, listeners, it's time to wrap up the reading of the Waterloo Courier with my favorite part of the paper, and maybe it is yours too. Call the Courier. Our first question today: why don't other city council members back up Margaret Klein in calling for the resignation of the police chief? Answer: apparently they don't agree with her, or if they do, they do not want to say so publicly. Question: where can I donate used glass eyeglasses? Answer: Walmart Vision Centers partners with the Lions Club to collect eyewear. Look for the blue and white Lions Club donation box. Goodwill partners with other nonprofits to provide low-income people with used eyeglasses. Question: why did Cedar Falls High School have graduation in Waterloo? Answer: the Cedar Falls Community Schools spokeswoman Janelle Darst said when planning was underway, COVID-19 protocols at the University of Northern Iowa, where commencement is normally held, would have required multiple graduation ceremonies. Young Arena was able to accommodate one. Question: how many RAGBI participants have been fully vaccinated? Answer: there is no requirement for vaccination, so there is no way of knowing how many riders will be vaccinated. According to organizers, RAGBRAI is recommending, not requiring, a few basic precautions: wearing masks when social distancing is not possible, and encouraging towns along the route to provide and promote outdoor dining at restaurants and bars. RAGBRAI will make hand sanitizers available at all vendor locations, in support vehicles that pick up tired riders, and for towns to use for entertainment venues and volunteers. It will also post appropriate COVID-19 signage at points along the route where participants are likely to gather in large numbers. Question: is Linda Ronstadt dead? Answer: singer Linda Ronstadt is still with us. Although she is retired from performing and recording, she was born in 1946 in Arizona. The 10-time Grammy winner turned 75 years old today, July 15th. I think I read her birthday at the start of today's reading. Question: why did Little Caesars go out of business on University? Answer: there's nobody there to ask. It could be related to the difficulties finding employees reported by restaurants around the nation since the pandemic began, or perhaps the rising popularity of food delivery service, which allow restaurants to cook for more customers from one location. And that does it today for the reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls paper for Thursday, July 15th, 2021. I'm your reader, Mary Dove. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.